Here now we have looked at the exegesis of verses 9 and 10. Let a widow be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years of age. Is it, anybody else warm in here?
No, that's not on. That's not on.
It, well, I think it is.
No.
Oh,
you gotta move that. Oh, I got you.
Okay. Let a widow, here Paul is going to spell out, as we know, very explicit instructions for how this one specific aspect, and again, I want to keep before us that this is not living grace in general. This is not spot assistance for widows or anyone. This deals with one specific issue of permanent full-time support by the local church. And so the standards, as you might expect, are going to be pretty high. Because first, Paul doesn't view the church as a charitable organization designed to cure the ills of society. That's what the church has largely become in some quarters, is simply that, a charitable organization that is designed to cure the ills of society. But that's not what it's here for specifically. So let a widow be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works. And the good works here are defined more specifically by proper raising of children, if she is a good mother, if she has shown hospitality to strangers. Now, we have to assume from the context here and what we've been given that the children are, for whatever reason, no longer alive. Otherwise, they would be responsible to take care of her. If she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. So a lot of ifs here. And again, I think Paul is intentionally repetitious here with the conjunction I in these first class conditions. If there's a series of responsibilities that if she has not maintained over her years as a woman, that she's not to be considered, frankly. And again, somebody's going to have to make a rather unpleasant announcement to women that don't meet up to these standards. And so, by application, as a younger woman, you may say, well, I never have to deal with this. Well, let's hope you don't. But I thought we'd be raptured by now, too. And apparently we're not. So a lot of things may happen that you don't anticipate happening. And if people were to look at your Christian life real carefully and have to evaluate you on regard to this, would you measure up over the years? Or would people say, no, she's spotty in Bible class, she doesn't apply very well, she's, you know, her house is always a mess, her kids are unkempt, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No, you're not going to go on the list then. We will not support you permanently. And that is the issue here. And again, a very specific, again, subset of what we might call living grace in general. Well, one here, having done this now, having spelled out some of the particulars with respect to the issue of widows and their support by the local church, Paul now moves to specific issues that Timothy must make certain are implemented in Ephesus. Two, as one might imagine, this material has generated a great deal of debate over the centuries as to the exact nature of what Paul is enjoining on Timothy in this section. Three major interpretations have emerged, two of which are actually not defensible if one deals with what is actually recorded in the text. For the first is that Paul is establishing an order of deaconesses, which must be rejected immediately for two specific reasons. The first reason is that Paul has already established the two offices he once filled in the local church in chapter 3. And both of those were only filled by men. I mean, there's no way you can read chapter 3 in an intellectually honest fashion and not come away with the idea that it has to be males. There is no defense in chapter 3 for a female deacon or, i.e., a female overseer as well. So that doesn't fly exegetically. The second is found in the fact that Paul uses the vocabulary of widows. He talks about widows specifically and does not use a feminine form of diakonos, which he does in another place. So the word was available to him and he had used it in another place, but he doesn't use it here. So, again, any idea that this is an official order of female deacons, as it were, that have to be 60 years old before they can even get in the ministry is indefensible. And common sense would tell you no. And again, the text is pretty plain on this as well. Five, the second is that Paul is establishing a special order of Christian workers in the local church, which were essentially viewed as female presbyters, i.e. elders or overseers. This view falls short on the same issue of vocabulary. Paul uses the term for widows and not some form of presbyteros, elders. And there is, again, a feminine form of presbyteros. And in fact, it is used in verse 2 of this chapter, older women. So again, it's a word Paul used, he was familiar with, he could have used it if this was what he was trying to establish. And that can't be documented just from the vocabulary. B, the second reason is found in the fact that the only mention of church offices are to be filled only by men. And then C, this would be highly unlikely since the woman was forbidden to occupy this office before she was 60. And no such age or requirement was given for overseers and deacons. If you go back and review the information in chapter 3, nothing is said of age. And in fact, as we know, Timothy was relatively youthful as compared to Paul and maybe some of the other overseers. So age is not ever listed as a qualification for a church office. And so, again, this falls short on that. He's not establishing female deacons and he's not establishing female overseers. Whose job is to go out sort of shepherd the church. That's not what he's doing here. Six, this view suggests seek support from the source of extra-biblical material, which seemed to suggest, again, I would highlight here, seemed to suggest that there was an order of female presbyters within the church. Seven, however, even in the extra-biblical literature, their accounts are conflicting. They do not all agree with the policies that Paul outlines here, and they offer various lists of duties which the widows were responsible to perform. Now, an important thing that you see here is, does Paul give a list of responsibilities that this widow is to do? No, it's not here. And certainly, they had official church responsibilities, then we would expect Paul to delineate what they were. I mean, what are we to just guess what they're supposed to be doing? No. He's very specific here on age, on the requirements, on the fact that all other means need to be exhausted. So wouldn't we expect Paul to say, hey, here's what I want these widows doing. And he doesn't talk about them in terms of what they're to be doing presently. He only talks about them in terms of their past Christian life. Now, we would assume, I would assume, that if their past Christian life was marred by these things, as it were, or marked by these things, these positive qualities, that she would continue exhibiting these positive qualities, that she would continue, as she could, to show hospitality, to wash the saints' feet, to, you know, she's not going to be raising children, obviously. She's a widow, for goodness sake. If a widow comes up pregnant, you got a problem. So, obviously, she's not going to be doing that. But the rest of it, you know, I would think these positive qualities would continue to mark her life. So eight, some have surmised, I like guessed, assumed, and you know what happens when you assume, that their duties surely included helping with the baptism of women, visiting the sick, visiting prisoners, teaching young women, and providing hospitality for strangers. And that's what MacArthur basically says, surely this has included this. Well, how, based on what? Well, his guess. That's all it is, his guess. There's no documentation from this. And by the way, do we hire some woman or get some woman to come in to baptize females? Doesn't the pastor just baptize everybody individually, whether they're a male or a female? Of course he does. So again, they have, and visiting prisoners is really stupid because in that day, visiting prisoners was very, very dangerous work. You associated with a prisoner, you yourself, it looked as though you were a criminal. That would have been very dangerous work to put on a 60-year-old woman. And I don't see that, because Paul makes it very plain in some of his later epistles that people risked their necks by hanging out with him when he was in prison. So again, they just guess this, they assume it, then they state it as fact, and guess what? It becomes doctrine. It's not doctrine. It's not true. Nine, these same interpreters cite such sources as Tertullian, Ignatius, and Polycarp, who wrote of widows in passing, just as they do orphans and virgins. But It doesn't make it doctrine because they wrote about them, but who never actually provided any details about a formal order of widows with any explicit record of their responsibilities. If you go read these extra-biblical sources, and they're available readily online, you can get them. You can read Tertullian's writings and all of that. They have them both in Greek and in English at certain sites. And I can give you the site if you're interested in reading some of these things. You'll see that they just wrote generally. They didn't write specifically, here are the widows and here's their job. It was just they wrote about them in passing. Essentially saying they should be righteous, which is what Paul says, isn't it? 10, therefore, the fact remains there are no duties prescribed for these widows in our passage, outside of their responsibility to engage regularly in prayer. And that's not even, if you go back and look at it carefully, it's not even, Paul's not even saying that's so much of a responsibility, it's just something that characterizes her life in verse 3. It says, she has fixed her hope on God and continues in treaty. He's not commanding her to pray, he's saying she does it as a normal course of her lifestyle. So, again, no qualifications outlined here and all of that. So, other than they have to be 60, they have to have a good reputation, and they have to have a solid doctrinal background to which people could give witness to. So, 11, in fact, Paul speaks of the qualifications for the list not as being future duties. He speaks of them as being documented in the past. Well, 12, the last and most satisfying interpretation, which is grounded in the language of the passage and the immediate surrounding context, is that the local church was to keep a record of genuinely destitute widows that qualified for full support by the local church. 13, the most serious argument against this interpretation is the fact that some do not like the idea that Paul establishes what they view as an arbitrary age for the full support of widows. They say, well, Paul just pulled this number out of his hat, so therefore this can't be right. And in some cases, obviously, one of the things, if you do any serious study on Timothy, any critical commentaries, some people will suggest this proves Paul didn't write the book. I don't know how it proves that, but that's their contention, that Paul wouldn't have said this. Well, how do you know what Paul would have said? Can you read Paul's mind now all of a sudden, 2,000 years removed? I don't think so. So again, the argument against this is that people don't like the list. They don't like the idea of the list, and they don't like the idea of the age restriction. And so they say, well, the church wouldn't have done this. Based on what? Again, based on what? Where's your proof? The text says Paul wanted it done this way. And again, by extension, God the Holy Spirit. Assuming that Paul's writing under inspiration, which that is my fundamental assumption. I go at the text with the idea that it's inspired by God. So 14, however, as some have pointed out previously, or as we have pointed out previously, the care of widows was something that the local churches had been doing practically from the time of Pentecost. Acts 6:1 is, again, fairly ancient in terms of the history of the church. We don't have, part of the problem is in the chronology of the early part of Acts, we can't fix exact dates. Now, we can fix Pentecost. It occurred in 33 A.D., same time as the crucifixion and resurrection, 50 days, in fact, after the crucifixion. And so we got a starting point, and we have an ending point for the book of Acts. But certain of the dates in between are vague, and they are not easily and readily documented. But certainly, Acts 6 is fairly early on in terms of the history of the church, probably within the first 10 years. And maybe even less than that. Maybe within the first 5. That would fit in the context of Acts in terms of chronology. So we see here the disciples, and then we had this cultural problem, as we know. The Hellenistic Jews, what we would call the liberal Jews, had a complaint against the native Hebrews, the more Orthodox Jews, because they said, hey, our widows are being cheated. And while this doesn't address the whole idea of taking care of widows, it's clear that it's something the church was already doing. And that very much, as we know, came over from the days of the synagogue. It's pretty evident. Any interpreter that's done any study at any level will tell you that the early church modeled itself in some ways on the synagogue out of which it came. And then things began to get more organized and structured, and the church began to assume more of its own identity. Part of the reason why the church was safe in the Roman culture for a long time was the church was just viewed as a subset of Judaism. And Judaism was religio licita in the Roman Empire, and so therefore the church was protected at a certain level. Now that changed after a point. The church really began to assume a completely separate identity that it did not necessarily have in the beginning stages. But, so here we see, you know, this, a lot of these things, as we know, came out of the synagogue. And the synagogue got it from the Old Testament. These are principles in taking care of widows that the Old Testament, as we've pointed out, clearly taught that this was the responsibility of people. So 15, therefore, Paul is not establishing anything new here, but sitting down definite policies and regulations as to how the full support of widows was to be administered in his canon. And by implication, I would say, in the larger canon of the world. And all this would apply to all local churches, I would assume. So 16, as with the commands for public worship and the ordaining of overseers and deacons. This suggests that a much more organized approach to the ministry than some are willing to admit. See, some people see the early church as being real haphazard and all over the place, and nobody was organized or structured. And that's why they don't like Paul's authorship, say, of 1 Timothy, because Paul's authorship of 1 Timothy suggests by that time, early 60s, a very organized, structured approach, down to a widow's list that was regularly maintained. And some people don't like that. They say, well, this couldn't have been this organized this fast. Well, God is a God of organization, as Paul said. He's not a God of confusion and chaos. He's a God of organization. Why wouldn't his policies and plans be organized? So, again, this is one of the ways they try to get around this, is they say, well, they weren't that organized. Oh, yes, they were. Yes, they were. They had very definite policies set down here, as we see. Paul tells, he spells out certain things about the false teachers and how to deal with them. And he does the same with Titus. He said, a factious man, after a first and a second rebuke, reject him. He sets down pretty definite policies for how to deal with things. Chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, he sets down specific policies for dealing with various categories within the local church. And when we get to 17 and 18 and beyond, he's going to set down very specific policies about elders. And these aren't, you don't have to guess what he thinks. He's going to tell you exactly what he thinks. So, again, as with the commands for public worship and the ordaining of overseers and deacons, this suggests a much more organized approach to the ministry than some are willing to admit. They want to believe that the church, again, was just haphazard, catch as catch can. And I don't see that even in the early stages, surely they went through a learning process and a learning curve, just as any local church will. It'd be nice if we could come out of the chute and say, hey, we've got it all together. Nobody does. If you find a local church that has it all together and is perfect, God, don't join it. You'll ruin it. Because you'll take your STA with you. So, again, you have to allow for growth and change and all of that in various periods you go through in your church history, corporately. Well, 17, it certainly appears from the earliest records in Acts that the local church had distinct policies that were put in place to administer its function. And this resulted, say, this complaint, this cultural bias, as it were, this cultural clash resulted in the formation of the office of deacon. So out of these problems, positive change came and positive growth occurred. And the apostle said, pick seven men. Why didn't they say pick eight? Why didn't they say pick five? Well, they had their reasons, I would assume. And the number was established of how many deacons they were going to have. So 18, when problems arose or the situation had not been addressed, the leadership moved to adopt plans and policies for the administration of some particular aspect of the local church. And in certain cases, that's how change and growth and all that occurs. You face problems, you face things you haven't thought about, and you have to deal with them. And this is a part of life. Isn't this how businesses improve their productivity and all of that? Is somebody runs into a problem and they say, hey, this can be done better. And they look at it and they come up with a better solution and all of that. But without the problem, you wouldn't have the positive growth. And so people say, well, there are a lot of problems in the local church. Get used to it. They had problems from day one. And you're never going to find a church that doesn't have them. But ideally, you take the doctrine, you work through it, you pray for wisdom, and you seek to implement what seems to be the best policies and procedures at that point. And if later on you find there's something wrong with it, you tweak it. And that's why, you know, that's why you can't say, well, we made a policy and we'll never, ever change anything. No, we'll look at it if we need to look at it. If there's a big, huge problem that needs to be addressed, we'll look at it. Well, 19, it should be evident that Paul would not have been addressing this issue if things had been properly administered in Ephesus to this point. 20, this should reiterate a very important point about the fact that the teacher wannabes were emphasizing all the wrong things. As we observed early in chapter 1, the true ministries of the church were suffering. Why? Because they were off on tangents. They were off on needless things. They were off on things that didn't edify. And some have questioned here why Paul has to address this. Were the teacher wannabes trying to attract a following among the widows and therefore catering to them at some level that Paul didn't? Could be. The best way to attract a following is get people to like you. And if you make policies that are in their benefit, they're going to like you. So who knows? I mean, that is in some way speculation, but the question becomes, why were they having problems in these areas? And the fact is, as we know, theology has a very practical way it has to play itself out in life or it's no good. Titus, the book of Titus addressed that the theology has to manifest itself in very practical ways. Theology that's just ivory tower theology is no good for anybody. You have to work through them. So again, they were paying attention to myths and endless genealogies which gave rise to mere speculation, rather than furthering the administration or the household of God. And so part of the household of God is how you're going to deal with widows. And so Paul's going to deal with that. And apparently it wasn't being done properly in Ephesus. So apparently, again, this had led to problems. 21, apparently the faulty emphases of the teacher wannabes had led to problems that Paul has addressed about the need for prayer, men leading in worship, women's decorum, placing qualified men into the two church offices, and now properly administering the Living Grace ministry for widows. 22, when sound doctrine is not being taught and sound policies are not established and enforced, the local church will inevitably fail in some or many of the ministries it is supposed to fulfill. So this requires thoughtful diligence. It doesn't require a jump and run, let's go get it done. You've got to think through these things. Consider them carefully. Take the doctrine you have and as much as possible reflect that in your procedures and policies. Now some people don't like procedures and policies, but they're anarchists. They don't like government at all, period. That's what an anarchist is. And we're going to deal with that coming up too. You know, what form of government should a church have? That becomes important when you get into issues of discipline. 23, the teaching of the truth coupled with proper procedures will allow us to correctly and appropriately administer God's household by providing all believers the information about how they are to conduct themselves. 1 Timothy 3:15, and that is the goal, to properly conduct yourself within the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. And guess what? When the local church doesn't function properly, the truth isn't properly upheld. And that's what we have to strive for. We pray that we will do things right, decently and in an orderly fashion, appropriately, properly, orderly, and that all believers will have an environment in which they can thrive spiritually. Not just get along, but thrive. And so the teaching is designed to reflect all this, and then we are to take the teaching and implement it in a very physical, real way in the local church. So 24, as we consider the qualifications that Paul directs Timothy to observe, it should be noted that these are given under the principle of inspiration. 25, these are not merely the words of Paul. These are the words of God, the Holy Spirit, who is directing that these standards be implemented in the local church. 26, the first thing we should make very clear is this is not a policy about Living Grace in general. This is a very specific policy about a relatively small segment of any local church and applies only to the issue of full and permanent maintenance for qualified widows. Again, I don't always put the word permanent in there, but I want to stress that because it's not just full maintenance, it's permanent maintenance. That this widow knows from now on out Let's say, but if we have a widow, if somebody becomes widowed in this local church, odds are we aren't going to have 15 or 20 of them. It's going to be a relatively small segment of the local church. And then we'll have to address that issue. And all of that. So again, we're not dealing with the broader issue of Living Grace only. So 27, a younger widow could come to the Living Grace ministry on isolated occasions and receive the help she needs. However, she could not be considered as a candidate for permanent support by the local church. So again, any believer that has a Living Grace need can obviously come and say, hey, I need help. Okay. That can be done at any time. Age is not a factor in that. Sex is not a factor in that. Anybody could get into a financial bind. And so, again, we're not dealing with the bigger issue here. We're dealing with a very isolated, small issue. 28, the fact that the local church was to have an organized and established record for this ministry, which would be a good idea for any aspect of Living Grace, which we do. We don't make the name public, but we announce the need, and at the end of the year, you'll get at the annual meeting, you get a report that says, okay, we had X amount of funds come in for Living Grace, we had X amount of funds go out, and other than that, we don't publish anything beyond that. We try to respect the privacy of believers. Who shouldn't, you know, and anybody could come for Living Grace. It's not an embarrassment. Shouldn't be. Believers ought to say, well, you know, hey, if I've got more and if I can help, fine. That's the attitude. And I think that's the attitude of most everybody here. Hey, I've got more. If you need help, let me know. And so we've never had a real problem with Living Grace. But beyond that, again, I think you should keep good records. And we do, and in fact, we're going to make the announcement. I'll mention it again here, but we'll make a formal announcement in December. We want one member of the congregation to volunteer to go with the treasurer and the other deacon, Clay, Bill and Clay, and go over the files and look at, and you're not going to get names of Living Grace or anything like that, but just look at the figures and guarantee and ascertain that they're correct and proper and that they all match. And that's just one. Do we have to do that? No. But we want to make sure that everybody knows, hey, this wasn't just done behind the scenes. The deacons didn't keep this all hush-hush. We don't have anything to hide. And so we'll ask for a volunteer probably in December for somebody to do that. And if you're inclined to apply in that area, then okay, you apply. So again, the local church should have an organized and established record, and it is seen in the command not to enroll her or not to put her on the list. 29, this clearly indicates that there was already an established protocol for keeping records of the Living Grace Ministry for widows, which apparently was not being observed. Now, any local church could fall into a problem in this area, but now Paul says, let's straighten it out. Let's start observing this. 30, alternately here, the teacher wannabes may have discouraged this practice as they sought to gain a following among those who may have been similarly disposed. And the quickest way, again, to get a following is go around and find people that have similar concerns as you and bend their ear and then get them to follow you. And I've seen this happen repeatedly in local churches. This isn't something, I wish it were related only to the fundies, but it's not. It happens in doctrinal churches as well. So that's very possibly what was going on here. Certainly we know there was a problem with the Living Grace Ministry for widows. What was the source of the problem? Well, certainly false teaching could have led to this. So 31, some may have wondered why Paul would choose the age of 60. But there are a couple of cultural and physical reasons that would explain this. 32, while the definition of old age was vague at times, one generally was viewed as old by the age of 60 or 65 in both ancient and modern cultures, which recognized 70 as the general lifespan. Psalm 90:10, which is the only psalm we have actually written by Moses, or the only extant psalm. In this book of Psalms. And Moses wrote, this would have been written, I'd say circa 1445 BC. He could have written as late as 1405 because Moses died in 1405. But it would have been within that 40-year period. from 1445 to 1405, during the time of the wandering of the Jews. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years. So the average lifespan 3,500 years ago was 70. What do you think it is today? Oh, about 72.1. With all our technology, we've increased it a whopping 2 years. The average lifespan was considered to be 70 years. Or if by strength, due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. For soon it is gone and we fly away. And any of those of us who are 50 old or 60 will tell you life goes by pretty fast. Like Ferris Bueller said, life goes by pretty fast. And it goes by faster than you might think. It doesn't seem like, but yesterday I was out playing baseball and I was 12. But it goes by pretty quick. So, and the years seem to speed up as you get older. But 70 is recognized as the general lifespan. And so one might not be surprised at all, I wouldn't think, to see that 60 is viewed as aged. It wouldn't shock me. Well, see, 33 here, since 60 was one recognized age in ancient cultures, at which one was deemed to have become an old man or old woman. It is not at all unusual that Paul employs this traditional figure. Now, for a while, and I don't remember what the age was. I know Social Security was younger than 62, but now you're viewed as old at 62. Old enough to retire, that is. And to start drawing your government-enforced support that you paid into all those years. So 34, apparently Paul considered the age of 60 to be the age at which a woman might no longer be subject to sexual passions, which might cause her to engage in illicit sexual activity. That is an issue that comes up later here in this chapter. And not just sexual passion, but romantic passion. That we recognize that females don't, you know, where men are turned on by what they see, women are turned on by what they hear. And so the need for romance does not necessarily decline maybe as fast in a female, as it were, as it does in a male. So he gets into this issue of when younger widows, don't put them on the list, verse 11, for when they feel, as it's translated here, sensual desires, but I'm not altogether sure that the word just relates to sex. Again, I think it relates to the togetherness, the closeness, the romance of a relationship with a male. That women love. God help you, women. Younger women apparently succumb to this much more readily than, say, a 60-year-old woman does, who by then has read all the romance novels, has gotten past the Hollywood hype and the living happily ever after thing and all that. She's seen a lot more of the world. Don't put younger widows on the list. They incur condemnation or a judgment. Because they've set aside their previous faithfulness and all of that. I don't like the word pledge here because this is the only time that word is translated pledge in all the New Testament. And I don't think it's a good translation, but we'll get to that in verse 12. Apparently Paul considered 60 to be the age at which a woman might no longer be subject to, and I would also put in here now, romantic or sexual passions, although the two are intertwined at some level. 35, further, this age is one at which a woman might not be prone to the excesses of travel, gossip, and inappropriate social activities that would violate her good standing within the local church. So 36, therefore, what might appear arbitrary on the surface had good physical, spiritual, and cultural reasons for being the age at which a woman could receive full maintenance or permanent maintenance. Again, inspiration notwithstanding. Let's not forget that God, the Holy Spirit, put this age in here. So 37, the second qualification is very similar to the qualification for the overseer and deacon. In fact, it is simply the reverse wording of the phrase man of one woman. In this case, it's woman of one man. So 38, in this case, the potential candidate for support had to have a history that manifested faithfulness to the principle of right man, right woman. Again, would a woman be disqualified from support because she had an incident of divorce once in her life? I don't see this verse as saying that. I don't think, that, of course, I tend to take the broader view of this, that this means faithfulness to the principle rather than a single marriage only. Because again, if Paul means a single marriage only, he's effectively going to disqualify all younger widows from future support. And I don't see him as doing that. So 39, as with the overseer and deacons, this is not teaching that only a single marriage is in view. 40, this is effectively demonstrated by the fact that Paul will enjoin younger widows to remarry, which would effectively disqualify them from any future help if they followed his advice. And some have argued here that Paul didn't write Timothy because it conflicts with Corinthians. What does Corinthians say? Well, Corinthians says, if you can, stay single. Now Paul says, hey, now get married. Well, which is it, Paul? What is it you want? Well, we will reconcile those two things as we deal with this, as we move on through here. Paul did write both books, and he did write both books under inspiration. But he's addressing, in some ways, different issues, as we will see. So 41, as Gromacki has stated, this could not be referring to a prohibition against a second marriage, or this situation creates an incongruity, which it really would. How can Paul mean married only once when he tells him to get married? Because that would, again, that would effectively disqualify him from any future help. So 42, therefore a widow did not have to be married only once. However, if she had been married, she must have demonstrated that she was a faithful wife by adhering to the principle of monogamous marriage. And obviously, since she's a widow, she has been married. But she's faithful to the principle of right man, right woman. If you're going to rule all people out of the ministry, out of support, out of everything because of divorce, you're going to have a real problem enforcing things in your church. Because the reality is that people fail. And they may fail, and guess what? They can rebound that failure, get their act together, and move on spiritually. Now, do we counsel people go out and get divorced? No, we counsel you to stay married. That's a divine institution number two for a reason. But if people fail in that area, and they do, I'm not going to write them off. Now, if you want to write them off and say, well, this means married only once, so therefore everybody's disqualified, that's your business. But I'm not going to. And I think you would do well to follow my example on that one. 43, verse 10, now introduces further spiritual qualifications that the widow must have exhibited in the past. These qualities would still be present with her, since they must be common knowledge. And they have to be common knowledge because of the whole idea here of the verb martyreo. Somebody's got to be able to bear witness to this. Well, the only people you can get to bear witness are her contemporaries. And so one would assume that she didn't, you know, I was a faithful woman all my life. I raised my children. I did right. And now I'm just going to go be a nutcase. I mean, some women might do that, but I would think that would be the extreme and not the norm. That would be the exception. So 44, this is documented by the use of the present passive participle martyreo, which would literally be translated as being witnessed. This would indicate that the testimony was offered from one of her contemporaries. And that's the beauty of, you know, a local church has some real advantages. And one of it is that we have reputations. People know us. You say, well, I don't always want everybody to know everything about me. Well, no, we still try to respect privacy, and you don't have to tell everybody everything. But the fact is, people can readily bear witness to what kind of a person you are. Are you a person that takes doctrine seriously? Do you work hard on your Christian life? Do you apply in areas where you're supposed to be applying? Do you fight the good fight in regard to your own STA? I mean, everybody can fight the good fight in regard to other people's STA. That's easy. Because that's not your problem, of course. And so everybody can clearly see where everybody else falls short. But are you the kind of person that recognizes, look, I fall short here, here, and here, and I know it. And I hate it, and I'm working on it. And I despise my failures. And all of that. Are you, you know, you talk to people, you can kind of figure out where they're coming from. And so this woman has people around her that know exactly what she's like. And in some cases, that would be good. In some cases, maybe not so good. Yeah, we do know what you're like. But this is good. And this is a part of being accountable to one another as believers. That we have to live up to certain standards. And sometimes we don't always do it. We recognize that. So we have to allow for failure and practice forgiveness and all those things. But the fact is, you still got a lifestyle that people observe, and they know what you are at a certain level. Now, they don't know everything about you. We recognize you have to allow for, there's things I don't know. But the lifestyle speaks for itself. And so here, her lifestyle speaks for itself. And people can readily step up and say, yeah. Yeah, this woman was a giver. She wasn't a taker. That's one of the things that stands out here to me. She's a giver. She's not a taker. Two kinds of people in the world, givers and takers. And this woman was a giver. 35 or 45 here. Therefore, Paul is not demanding that widows are responsible to do these things in the future, but acknowledging that they have been known for such actions in the past. And again, as younger women, whatever your age may be, you ask yourself, would I qualify under this? Am I the kind of woman that people would say, yeah, she's done this stuff. You can count on her. Or would they say, nah, not really. Nah, no, that's not her. And because if that's not her, when the time comes, should the time ever come, the local church is going to say, no, that's not you. And again, that would be a hard thing, but it would be something that would have to be done. So 46 here, Paul begins with a general statement that the widow that would qualify for full maintenance was to be the type of woman that could adduce witnesses to the quality of her character. And that's what you got to ask yourself. What would people say about me? What would people say about you if they were asked, what kind of character does this person have? Are they serious about doctrine? Have they shown hospitality? Have they brought up their children right? Now, it doesn't mean that the children may not go off and be idiots, but did they raise them right? Did they do the best job they could? Were they serious about it? Were they diligent parents? Or were they permissive parents and their children grew up to be idiots because they never were disciplined? That would be a hard question, but you'd have to ask it. Why are the children idiots if they turn out to be idiots, let's say? Hopefully they wouldn't. But clearly, again, the children are not in view here in that they're not in the picture anymore, or they would be having to take care of her. So for whatever reason, her children aren't an issue, but how she raised them is. That becomes the bigger issue. So 47, no doubt these witnesses must have come from the local church in Ephesus and could readily inform the leadership about the propriety of placing her on the list. That's one of the things the leadership would have to do. I don't think, my opinion at this point, is the leadership wouldn't unilaterally make a decision. You would interview people. You would do some homework and some research. Hey, this woman has applied for permanent full support. What kind of woman is she? If you didn't already know. Now, in a local church this size, we'd probably have some pretty good ideas. But there might be things we didn't know. And so you would have to hold that out and I would think do some interviewing with the congregation. Hey, what do you know about this woman? What can you tell me? Well, she went to the bar a lot. Well, that might be something that a woman would not necessarily make public to the leadership, but she left her kids alone a lot. Well, you wouldn't want to make that public knowledge, but then there would be people that would know that about you, of how did they raise their children appropriately? No, she was abusive, man. I saw her use wire coat hangers on them. That's not an appropriate way to discipline a child. God made a place for him to be spanked. It's not in the face. It's on the butt. And so was she a good disciplinarian? Not abusive on the one hand and not permissive on the other. These are the kinds of questions you'd have to ask. What kind of mother was she? So 48, what is described here in general terms as a reputation for good works is more clearly and exactly defined by a series of first-class conditions that follow. 49, these works are comprised of some items that are moral in nature, and some that have to be understood in the terms of the cultural realities of Paul's day. 50, these conditional clauses assume the truth of what is going to be said in each case about the precise nature of her good works. And so when he says, having a reputation for good works, the first-class condition here assumes that she's done these things. If she has brought up children, i.e. raised them properly, and all that that entails. If she has washed the saints' feet, assuming she has. If She has assisted those in distress. And if she has devoted herself to every good work. Those are the questions you have to ask. But again, the first class condition here assumes that she has. 51, the first deals with the manner in which she has dealt with her children in the home. And that is clearly a moral issue. The children could have been her own. Or some have suggested that she may have aided orphans as well. And in that case, in that society, of course, in that time, it was viewed as a very great application. And that some people who were more well-to-do than others would take orphans into their household and raise them like they were their own children. And certainly this would focus first and foremost on her own children. That would be first and foremost. But she may have helped other children. You know, I know of situations where, say, aunts have in large measure jumped in and fulfilled the role of mother towards children whose mother was otherwise an idiot. You know, or say, you know, again, brothers and sisters, you know, maybe someone stepped in and took up the slack for this person. They essentially raised other people's kids as though they were their own, treated them like they were their own. Obviously, that's a high level of application. That's a good thing to do if the situation demands it from you. So, again, some have suggested this could be orphans, but it could just be children in the extended family. Again, say your sister or your brother was an idiot and you looked out for their kids and helped them and took them under your wing and all of that. I know a guy out there where I work. This guy effectively, you know, he's known this guy a lot of his life. When the guy was a teenager, he started coming over and hanging out with the guy's kids, and he took him essentially into his home and treated him like he was his own kid, took him under his wing, took care of him, helped raise him and all that. And apparently this young guy spent as much time with this family as he did with his own family. And so that would be a good thing. That would be an appropriate application if it became an issue in your niche. So again, 52, this is not teaching the necessity of having children in order to qualify. If you read this as, oh, the widow must have had children. No, I don't see that either. I mean, if she had children, she has to raise them right. But what if the widow was married for 50 years and they never had children? You're going to tell her she can't be on the list because she didn't have kids? I don't think so. I don't see this as being a command that she has kids. Just that if, again, there are children in a home. Same way back in chapter 3, if you look at the deal with the pastor. Managing his own household well. Keeping his children under control with all dignity. Does this demand that he have children? I don't think so. But if he does have children, the household has to be operated in a particular way. And the same thing, again, was incumbent on deacons. Verse 12. Well, obviously, let's say you didn't have kids. Does that disqualify you from being a pastor or a deacon or a widow for support? I don't think so. I don't think you have to have children. But I think if you do have, and eventually at a certain point, no matter if you do have children, they grow up and they leave the house. And so then at a certain level, you're off the hook with regard to those kids. You've done your job and you're off the hook. So, and again, clearly here she would not have children in the home or otherwise they would be responsible. So again, I don't think this is teaching the necessity of having children, but again, it should be understood that if she had children, she had exhibited the physical and spiritual qualities that make for a good mother. 53, in any case, it should be evident that her children, or any that she might have had a hand in raising. Again, you might have, as a parent, you might have had opportunity to help other people and deal with their kids and take care of them and all of that. And if that's the case, it should be evident that they are no longer able to testify. They're not alive, or certainly, you know, they'd be responsible. They're not alive to testify on her behalf. So again, this would have to be pretty well known in the local church, would have to be pretty common knowledge that this was that kind of woman. People know. People figure it out. All right, well, our time is up, so let's stop there, and we will continue here. I'll be sending out the new notes for the rest of this. Well, not all the chapter, but for the part I got done this afternoon. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.